art, culture, politics, activism. Now, art in the pandemic age. Have you ever wondered why artists do what they do? What is their purpose? What are they trying to accomplish? I'm your host, Kyle Roman. Welcome to Artivism Now. Welcome to episode 5 of Artivism Now. I am your host, Kyle Roman. Today we start a special series in which we profile the Community Rejuvenation Project in Oakland. CRP Bay Area is working on a project entitled the 360 Mural. We will profile each artist involved, and we're starting today with the founder of CRP and artistic director of the 360 Mural, Desi Mundo. All right. We are here with Desi Mundo, who is the founder of CRP Bay Area. CRP is an organization that does what they call pavement to policy, and it is all about public art and education and the beautification of our communities. So welcome, Desi.
What up?
Thanks for joining us today.
No problem. Glad to be here.
Yeah, so we're actually spotlighting you for this awesome project you have coming up called the 360 Mural in Oakland on 360 14th Street in Oakland. Maybe if we can, before we get into the complete project, let's talk a little bit about CRP. And in your mission, you talk about pavement to policy. That's kind of like, one of your guys' slogans for the organization. Can you walk us through what pavement to policy means to you with the work that CRP does?
Yeah, definitely. We started out on the pavement. You know, we've been doing murals. I've been painting murals for the past 30 years. And I've done several hundred easily. We had a couple of years there where we banged out 100 in like probably 2 to 3 years, over 100 between 2010 and 2012. We did 33, 25, and then 67. So just that 33 and 67 adds up, 125 in 3 years. Mm-hmm. And, now I think we're kind of a little bit less productive in terms of numbers. But we're more focused on kind of like the quality and the community engagement aspects and stuff like that. And through this experience that we've developed doing murals in all different types of locations with all different types of collaborators and stuff like that, we use our experience to talk about public art policy. And we use our experience to talk about, what's the best practices, but more about like what can, governments do to, eradicate some of their, more bureaucratic and problematic methodology, and what can be done to improve situations for public artists around the country, around the world. So we do a lot of research on public art. We write critiques on particularly local policy, but we can extend it nationally. We've been highly critical of the graffiti abatement industry and the bottomless black hole of money that people keep pouring their money, millions and millions of dollars down this drain. Mm-hmm. Of buffing out, walls and stuff like that. And we have, we present alternatives. Mm-hmm. And we also, in this process, have also advocated and gotten, substantive funding for the community, not just for ourselves. Mm-hmm. We were part of a coalition that got an additional $400,000 added to the budget 1 year for community murals. We got a little piece of that, but there was a lot of other arts organizations mm-hmm. in the area that benefited. We're consistently advocating for that type of support, and to make avenues, to create avenues for artists to get support for their work without, the piles and piles of paperwork and red tape that can kind of come along with it. However, that, with a certain amount of, a sense of the need to engage community as part of this process. Because we're not just trying to create work, especially nowadays in this time, where, the demographic of writing has changed, mm-hmm. And what it's used for has changed. And so murals can be tools for gentrification very easily, right, if they're not, engaging the community in a meaningful way. And we see it very often in Oakland, and we see it all around the country and around the world. Mm-hmm. So,
I see your point, and I've definitely seen it in my own experience going down to Southern California. An example would be the LA Arts District. It used to be, just the place to see public art, and now it's kind of like more of a gentrified neighborhood. Whereas if you go into like Boyle Heights and you go into East Los Angeles, you'll see more of an organic kind of pavement work, just like you guys do. So how important is it for CRP to advocate for less flight from urban communities?
I think that there's always going to be writing, right? And the question is, what are we going to do with that situation?
Right.
And, we have successful models where, rather than just painting it out, employing people, training people, giving, youth opportunities, and creating art in those spaces has proven to be more cost effective, more, actually produces something that we're proud of. You're a buffer. You're part of the public works department in your city. Mm-hmm. At the end of the year, you're totaling up all the stuff that you did, and it's a bunch of blank walls with half-ass, marks, eraser marks, just because mm-hmm. someone chose to write on them. There's no improvement to the quality of the wall. There's no best practices of how to actually paint and protect the wall in a way that it won't fall apart later, because they're just very quick and half-assed. And there's really nothing to show for it other than probably someone went back to that same spot and wrote on it within a week or two. Mm-hmm. And if you're creating murals in those spaces, they might get bombed. Writers nowadays are not necessarily as particular, and sometimes they see it as an opportunity to maybe last a little longer if they hit the right spot. But even if you have to go back and repaint your mural or touch up that space, at the end of the day, you're going to have all of this, additional benefits to the community that came along with, artists and youth got employed. You created something that the community was proud of. Mm-hmm. You brought the community together. You could have potentially tell stories and help define the identity of a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. All of those things are added bonuses that come along with public artwork that don't come along with abatement. And for the amount of money we're spending on abatement, we might as well be doing public artwork. Okay. Because the national abatement budget's been going up exponentially since they've been tracking that budget. Mm-hmm. and the penalties for writing have gone up exponentially since they, you know, you like, I always use this anecdote. 1982, in the film Star Wars, Mayor Ed Koch, they've been bombing New York like insanely mm-hmm. for 15 years, right? Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, getting all serious, and they're putting two fences and dogs running in the middle of them, and whoop de whoop, you know, like, oh, yeah. we spent all weekend, but we cleaned every train. And the penalty that he suggests for a repeat offender is 3 to 4 days in jail, right? You take how $400 worth of damage, which is completely arbitrary. Mm-hmm. You can write on someone's toenail and it could be $400 worth of damage, right? Because there's no way that, I mean, like, I could find a way to bill $400 for cleaning someone's toenail.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And not to be funny, we've documented on our website that exact behavior happening where they privatized graffiti abatement, you know, and then the private company was price gouging. They would go over to a swing set and paint the seat of the swing and charge for 10 square feet, you know? And, you know, like, so it is completely arbitrary. $400 as the, you know, the mm-hmm. cost that elevates the damage from a misdemeanor to a felony. So every rider, when they're arrested, is immediately hit with a felony charge that they plead down to a misdemeanor, right? Mm-hmm. Unless you really did something, you know, egregious, and then they're gonna actually try to hit you with a strike, you know, mm-hmm. and so basically, like, 1 year in jail is the minimum amount of time for a felony, probation, you know, huge fines, all of that stuff. And that's just, you know, that one circumstance is not even discussing gang and hate. So you went mm-hmm. from 4 days, 1982, to a year in 2020, right? For the same activity, right?
Yeah.
Has it deterred anything? Has it caused anything to slow down? No. Whose budgets have ballooned? Mm-hmm. The police and the abatement agencies. Have they shown any meaningful results that would say to you, oh, okay, that was worth it, or this process has actually, you know, deterred vandalism longitudinally over time? Yeah, we might have stopped it for that moment, but 6 months later, do we still have the same problem? You know, if we're still spending that much money or more to abate graffiti in 2020, and the price keeps going up and beyond the adjusting for inflation, then your process for eliminating it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work.
Right.
So, you know, you can keep doing the same thing and trying to say, all right, you know, it's going to work now, but at some point you got to realize that there ain't making you and it ain't working, you know? Mm-hmm. And who's rainmaking you? It's the police, mm-hmm. the abatement agencies, and the private consultant, and the chemical companies that sell us the products for most efficient removal, right? And I've been to their conferences. I've mm-hmm. been to their events. And I see how it works. They're all mad because California has actual regulations on what chemicals can be used. If we could just use this stuff, man, we'd really be cleaning. You know, I literally, that's a quote from one of them, you know?
Oh my God.
So, you know, and this all goes back to a failed public policy theory called broken windows. Mm. And broken windows was the same one that was arresting all the jaywalkers, all the turnstile hoppers mm-hmm. and stuff like that. Because if you have the small crime, you know, it just leads to the sense of chaos and the idea that we can create more crime.
Right.
And that theory came out, it was George Kelling and one other guy had this theory debunked within like 2-3 years, but every city latched onto it. And they've been using that as their strategy since that time, despite the fact that it's been proven to not work. There's so many other factors in determining whether or not, you know, crime is going to increase in the neighborhood. And it only takes into consideration property crimes, because, you know, where does that, where does white collar crime fit into that analogy? You know, like we're only thinking about, you know, conditions where, you know, poor communities, communities of color, disinvested communities, redlined communities. We're only targeting them in terms of this, in the same way that, you know, the penalties for white collar crime are much smaller than the penalties for, you know, blue collar crime, including vandalism. I could extort $1 billion from as a bank CEO and do less time than what I'm going to do for catching a tag on a BART train. These are facts. So, you know, it's a systemic problem. And we just sit there and we just point out the facts. We just point out, hey, yo, that's a really bad idea. Hey, you really want to do it that way? That's stupid. This isn't going to work. And then guess what? It doesn't work. So that's kind of what CRP has been doing.
It's amazing how tied in with the criminal justice system that the public art movements are. And you provided a great history of it too, going back to 1967 and then even Mayor Ed Koch in New York City. And a lot of those policies, amazingly enough, just like, you know, from watching a few documentaries, I could, like, those neighborhoods were the ones that grew hip hop culture through all of that heavy crackdown on property crimes, like you had said. And so now turning back to Oakland, at least what it seems like from an outsider's point of view, is taking a different approach in terms of encouraging public art that is Oakland-based. So if you could maybe educate me on whether that's correct, is the infrastructure, the leadership in Oakland actually supporting what CRP does?
Yes and no.
Okay.
We've worked very well, been very successful in applying for funding from the city's cultural funding program. And the city's cultural funding program is a pretty good program. We're always advocating for them. I think that their process for selecting people to be funded is equitable. There are challenges. There's a ton of bureaucracy before you actually get the funds. Public artists are subjected to an additional screening process, which goes beyond the, you know, any other art, you know, theater performances don't have to go through a committee to get their art approved. And I've been pretty vocal about saying, I don't think that that's such a great thing. I do understand that the city's purpose in doing that is to ensure that we are actually engaging the community and that the city's funding people that are doing work in those communities. The problem is that there's no allocation for us to prepare those applications, which are extensive. It's just like writing another grant. It takes hours and hours. You know, who's going to pay you for that? Nobody. You just got to do it. And you're like, damn, I just spent 10 hours of my life. Most people get paid for working for 10 hours. And also because the funding for public art projects and cultural funding in general is generally maximizes at $20,000. That sounds like a good amount of money for a project, but then to do a significant engagement process, to do a significant, you know, sizable mural, that money gets spent pretty quick. And so oftentimes engagement is just assumed to be on the artist to go do that. And of course, both the public and the city all hold the artist responsible for their ability to engage and how much work that they did to actually talk to the community. But there's not a whole lot of support to actually do that. Now, the project we're currently working on has gotten support for just that, for just those purposes. Mm-hmm. And so it is out there, but those are like, you know, I mean, I don't want to, like, we are recipients of the Creative Work Fund grant. Mm-hmm. But that, to me, I've always viewed Creative Work Fund as kind of the top echelon of funding in the Bay. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but it's kind of like, for a project-based grant, it's probably one of the largest ones.
Okay.
And it's very hard to get. You have to be really doing some pretty dynamic work to get it.
Yeah.
And so there needs to be more larger scale funds to be accessible to the public so that we can do this work easier. You know, that's ultimately what we're going to need to do that. One of the good things about Oakland, though, is that if you're not getting city funding, there's no bureaucracy about painting in the community. Mm-hmm. Technically you talk to the owner and you paint. Mm-hmm. You make whatever arrangement you make with them, and you do your work. So you're not blocked from, you know, being able to do the work, which some other places are proposing that, and some other places are doing that. We don't need that. We need to be able to have, you know, once we've done the work, we need to have protections from the city painting over us.
Right.
What we don't need is something at the beginning of the process to slow us down and to fill out paperwork and to get approval to be allowed to express ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, so we've been consistently, you know, advocating just to make it easier for us to have protections, to make it easier for us to have, you know, support, and you know, and then to streamline the bureaucracy. And this, you know, they did streamline some of this stuff. It hasn't made it that much faster, but they did do some. Their paperwork is a little easier in the last year, but the biggest issue is that, you know, part of the bureaucracy, part of the slowdown is they don't put enough money into the program, you know, and they also derive the funds from two different places, which is the general fund in Oakland, which is kind of always there, although now it's under a significant attack because COVID and stuff like that. The general fund's going to diminish. We have a huge debt in Oakland. And the hotel tax is the other major area that pays the transient occupancy tax. And the arts only get like a half a percent, but the tourism bureau gets 50%. And so we really feel that, why not let the arts themselves be the thing that represents the identity of the city? Because the Tourism Bureau has consistently failed to recognize, let alone promote, Oakland's historic cultural and arts institutions. And they focus their attention on the newer, you know, the newer arts venues and stuff like that, and put their energy into promoting that versus, you know, world-class, international, African drum dance. And the city does not really showcase that, and the tourism group did not showcase that. You could be coming, you know, to see this and coming to really know about this incredible history that we have here in Oakland, and instead you're like, you know, you're coming for the, you know, our big First Friday events and stuff like that. No diss to those events, but you know, there's a lot more to Oakland than that, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of like been one of our positions as well.
And you described that nicely, and especially alluding to the rich cultural and artistic history in Oakland. Just if you could, from your own perspective, maybe fire off a few names of people, Oakland artists or performers or whoever, that influenced you growing up. And I think that kind of leads into our discussion of the 360 mural.
Well, bad news, bro. I'm from Chicago.
Okay.
So all of my main influences growing up were Chicagoans.
Yeah, okay, cool.
So yeah, like, I mean, in the Bay since I got here, you know, been influenced by so many. Particularly in Oakland. I mean, I moved to Oakland the year that Mike Dream was killed. He died like a month after I got here. And so I never got to meet him, but his name and his presence in Oakland is still felt so strongly. His crew has been really, TDK has been really good about carrying on his legacy. And they're just, every time you hear the name TDK, it's preceded by the legendary. So it's like they're you know, always been, you know, a powerful force in the Bay. And I respect them a lot. In terms of, you know, I was schooled early on when I came here about some of the history. And I like, you know, I've been influenced a lot by this crew out here called TWS, Together with Style. Not so much like trying to emulate them, but just kind of that they were had a really like wild approach. And were trying to do stuff that was very different. And I just respected that a lot. Of course, you know, like, you know, I like the, you know, it's also San Francisco. So, you know, TWS is more of a San Francisco crew. But also the standard, you know, like kind of funk style riders, you know, FSC crew and, you know, KTD and, they're all people that I've really like admired their work for different reasons, you know. And in San Francisco, I really like the work of Apex. He's just always been someone that I really like enjoy his pieces and stuff like that. I've met him, been friends with him for a while, and think that he's dope. And they're just, man, the list is so long, dude. Like that, and those are just the writers. Like, for me, right. I'll also, like, and I guess we can use this to lead into what we're talking about. Also, the muralists.
Yeah.
I mean, I've, like, the Bay has really got, like, this deep historical mural legacy, you know, from Presida Ives and Susan Cervantes. And Susan Cervantes is one of the, you know, the primary teachers of Twin Walls Mural Company, who's one of the groups that are collaborating on this piece with me. So I'm, you know, like, there's just all these powerful women muralists: Juana Alicia, Marta Ayala, Susan Cervantes, Edith Boone, just, you know, so many. Miranda Bergman. And then also these men, you know, Keith Sklar, Dan Fonts, Dan Galvez, John Worley. Oh God, what, I just saw a picture of this guy today, and his name is on the tip of my tongue. We painted a lot with John up in Richmond. Herschel Walker, or Herschel West. I'm trying to. So like that traditional Trump Low. Very vibrant murals, the Carnival mural, the Grand Performance, even the one right around the corner from this mural that we're doing now, Mitzvah. It was, I was just like, man, this is huge, super colorful. you know, so there, so the traditional muralists have had a lot of presence in my life. I feel bad, like, naming people. I'm like on the spot, and I'm like, oh, there's all these other people that I want to say, you know.
Yeah,
like,
sorry about
how
that.
How far do you want me to go?
Yeah, you fired off a lot of names, so
yeah. And unfortunately, I've been able to, you know, interact with a lot of these folks and mm-hmm. collaborate with them in certain situations, and
speak to the collaboration, because there are so many young and old school artists the same. Like, speak to the collaboration level in the Bay Area in terms of projects. Like, is this the place to come and collaborate?
It can be, yeah. There's definitely a lot of, you know, cross pollination among artists. Everybody kind of knows each other, mm-hmm. and when there's, particularly among writers, when there's like just like a free wall that we all just kind of want to pile onto, mm-hmm. you know, that's definitely something that happens. And mm-hmm. We've been fortunate to collaborate with just recently with like a couple of the folks from Trust Your Struggle. You know, and CRP has always kind of had this organic, like, you know, it was never like rigid crew. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, like, we're open to people coming in, we're open to volunteers, participating, and trying to just find a way to kind of like, you know, have you get in where you fit in. Mm-hmm. And even on this project, we've been doing that, you know, to the extent that we can. There's definitely some limitations, because we're using some pretty, you know, serious machinery mm-hmm. to access the top of the wall and the majority of the wall. But we're pretty open to having people kind of like participate with us, mm-hmm. You know, as we can, you know, and mm-hmm. I try to be as personally. I think that being inclusive is just a really, you know, important part of this work, and that's what I kind of strive for in this process. If there's a way to pull you in, and if you want to get involved, then we'll see what we can do to make it happen. Mm-hmm. That's how it's been.
Moving on to the 360 mural project itself, it is a collaboration between multiple artists. And so maybe if we could start talking about that project, and maybe let's lay out the names of people, because these are people that we're going to interview on this program as well, leading up mm-hmm. to the culmination of the project. Who are the major players that we're going to be talking to?
Well, technically I'm the lead artist, and I've hired a team of assistants to work with me. And then we also have a bunch of folks volunteering. Mm-hmm. But it, at the moment in particular, it doesn't feel like that. You know, we're collaborating with the Twin Walls Mural Company, which is Marina Perez Wong and Elaine Chu. Mm-hmm. And that's been an amazing experience already. Mm-hmm. They are very meticulous, technically gifted, just really fun to work with, really enthusiastic, but so talented. And so let me just say something, like,
yeah,
to back it for just a minute.
For sure.
This piece, there's a lot that goes into this piece, and we can get into how it came about and
yeah,
all of that. Back in 2013, we had approached the city saying we wanted, hey, let's give us a wall in downtown. Mm-hmm. We want to do something that's like a little bigger, a little larger scale. And we were pointed to walls at 14th and Alice Street, which is just a few blocks from the new project. Mm-hmm. And we ended up doing a very robust, probably the most robust engagement process that we'd ever done. We interviewed over 50 culture keepers and local residents. We did like multiple presentations in the community. And we just, you know, did a lot of, you know, independent research, came to come up with a design, which we finally executed 2 years later, starting in 2015 mm-hmm. and then finishing in 2016. There was like a delay between the first stage and the second stage in that process.
Mm-hmm.
And about 3 months after we finished that project, we found out that a developer had bought the parking lot in front of the walls. So the walls were fine, but they were going to build in front of it so you wouldn't see the mural. And this was part of the city's policy, going back to our policy stuff, to, mm-hmm. you know, target ground level parking for development. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, they're offering us these walls and investing in us painting it and us putting years and years of time and energy into this process. And then on the mm-hmm. other hand, they're actively trying to get this space to, you know, develop so that no one's going to see it.
Okay. Can I interrupt you for a sec? Cause I feel like I've seen this before. Is this the wall that kind of has like, it's kind of like a, it forms kind of like a right angle in a parking lot. And then it's a blue backdrop with a bunch of cultural figures from the past. It's been around for a long time. Yeah. Is that the one? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that, it's four. It's, there's actually four walls in it. Mm-hmm. The tallest one was 4 stories tall and about 100 feet wide.
Uh-huh.
And it featured people like Ruth Beckford, the godmother of Oakland dance.
Yeah.
Malanga Cascalord, one of the mm-hmm. early Congolese, you know, African drumming and dance teachers, Zach Diouf,
mm-hmm.
His companion Naomi Diouf, Felipe Osumare, Carla Service, Takuma King, Moshe Milan. I mean, just the, you know, you throw a rock around that neighborhood and you're going to hit like a legendary international artist.
Yep.
Axis Dance Company. It was just, you know, and then all of these other people in the community who were, you know, like Khalil Shaheed, who was the head of the Oaktown Jazz Workshop,
mm-hmm.
Who had passed away. Jerry Lange, who was like a famous person on early, you know, early pioneer of African-Americans on TV on the mm-hmm. West Coast, and her son who passed away in the process of right before we finished the mural, he passed away like mm-hmm. a week or two before, Michael Lange.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course there's this other community across the street, Hotel Oakland, with all houses all these Chinese seniors. So we started incorporating the history of Chinatown and
mm-hmm.
All of their cultural expressions and activities. So there, it was just this very, powerful representation of Oakland, you know, and people, and I don't want to like say, but it really, like I say it's powerful because it resonated with people,
mm-hmm.
you know, the people in the community would film their dance videos, their music videos in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
People would take a lot of pictures in front of it. Tourists would come to take photos.
Yeah.
You know, it was just kind of it became like a major stop in downtown Oakland in terms of public art. And so it was almost immediately was threatened with being covered.
Yeah.
And again, we worked with the community and organized to block the developer's application
mm-hmm.
Or to appeal the developer's application. It was approved immediately, rubber stamped immediately. And we appealed that and brought the developer to the table, and the developer had to not only fund a mural in a new location, but also had to, make some substantive improvements to the Malanga Cascalord Center, mm-hmm. And also like do other things like funds for some parking because of the parking was being removed. And,
right.
And then that coalition stayed together and went after other developers. So it was a coalition of the Chinatown Coalition like an artist, and that's they went amazing. After other developers, and the benefits started to really stack up, and they ended up with about $20 million in community benefits. So fast forward to, I would say 2018, I don't know. We were kind of like in a holding pattern, trying to figure out where we're going to do things and waiting for them to start development. Mm-hmm. And I did a project, where I was an assistant to Dan Fonts in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And I had already observed that the way we had done all this work to create this mural, but we did it all with spray paint.
Mm-hmm.
And color, you know, spray paint is a great medium, but it's not very good for you know, to last.
Right.
The colors fade very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so when it came down to doing this project, I decided that it's going to be primarily acrylic. And I had worked with Dan just prior to this, kind of helping him touch up one of his acrylic murals. Mm-hmm. And kind of getting put up on a lot of the knowledge around, the best techniques for, you know, making a mural vibrant.
Mm-hmm.
And so this piece is primarily going to be acrylic, and it's going to primarily be brushed on. So I reached out to artists that have more experience brush painting, but I don't really brush paint.
Yeah.
You know? And so this whole process for me is actually a massive learning experience.
More on the conceptual side, right?
So this is where in particular, so far, where Twin Walls comes in is that
mm-hmm.
they come from the Presida Eyes School, or Susan Cervantes School,
mm.
painting murals, which is very much, you know, primarily brush paint, acrylic paint,
mm-hmm.
and very, like, technically knowledgeable and kind of that older process for painting.
Yeah.
And so when they showed up, you know, in particular, like they were super knowledgeable about making grids, which I knew about, but on this scale, we had to do a lot of calculation and recalculation
mm-hmm.
just to get that laid in. And then now we're in the process right now of actually drawing in the images off the grid. And it's just this, you know, like for none of us have done a wall this big,
mm-hmm.
but their experience working with brushes and working with grids and stuff like that is teaching me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really just thankful, you know, because everybody that we're bringing into this has, you know, knowledge and experience that I don't, you know, I'm just kind of like technically the lead, and I made the design that we're executing
mm-hmm.
Through a similar community process, but I'm also very much a student and mm-hmm. trying to just sort of like facilitate these talented people into getting into this work that we're going to do. And so it's been always called, just to clarify, it's always been called the 360 mural because we didn't have a name for it.
Mm.
Just like the previous mural was always called the Alice Street mural because it was on Alice Street.
Yeah.
But we actually named that one the Universal Language, but a lot of people don't call it that. And this one is going to be called Ascend Dance, like one word with Ascend with capital D.
Uh-huh.
So like, you know, kind of like that rising, you know, into our maximum potential that was discussed in the design process.
Yeah.
So we're working with Twin Walls Mural Company, Elaine and Marina. Mm-hmm. It's been such a blessing to work with them. They're very thorough. They're very positive. They're meticulous.
Nice.
And in this stage in the process, it's been so helpful to have someone who is just really, really like, we're going to get all of these lines right. We're going to get this laid out right, and we're going to make sure that this goes right. Yeah. And their commitment to this process is so amazing.
Yeah, no, we can't wait to hear more from Spencer when we talk to him as well, go a little bit deeper into the documentary. Yeah. One thing about the documentary, we'll definitely put the link on all of our social media that we send out with all of these episodes. We'll make sure that we put links out there so people can watch it and get some eyes to it. Mm-hmm. And so the you were talking earlier about the team that was formed around preserving that specific property and art space. Is that coalition of people, are they involved at all in are they involved at all in CRP or the 360 mural project and how it came about?
Definitely in the project. You know, a lot of the people who were actually, what's crazy is, you know, I'm trying to count, but there's at least 4 images either from Alice Street, the film,
mm-hmm.
or from the protest, or, you know, like, just people. I mean, there's plenty of the original people from the original mural.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, none of those are the same images. We didn't repeat any images. Right. However, there's at least 4. Naomi, Theo, Carla, Leilan. I'm just trying to run through my brain and see if there's anybody else on it. Who, that was actually photos or images from the film itself.
Mm.
So kind of like, you know, and they all, and the only one that wasn't actually, didn't come to any of the meetings was Naomi.
Mm-hmm.
And she's the artistic director of Diamante Cora, so she's just busy.
Mm-hmm.
But she, you know, like, you know, it's a lot, those relationships that were built on the first project remain.
Mm-hmm.
And we're, you know, it's just a important, beautiful community. And it's difficult too, because not everybody from the first mural is on this new mural.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's, you know, for me, it's just more motivation to say, hey, let's go get more walls. It's great.
Right. Yeah.
You know, there's until and some, because the story shifted a little bit from the first mural to the second mural.
Mm.
What the community asked for changed a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, you know, like, we may want to go back and revisit some of those first stories, or tell them a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
to get this, you know, I mean, there's always going to be more stories to tell, you know, if you continue to really do this work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that there's a lot of, you know, I look forward to, you know, doing my best to catch up and try to re-honor the people from the first project.
Yeah.
You know, that's actually some of the hardest parts of this is, you know, selecting folks, and, you know, that's always difficult. Mm-hmm. And there's just so many people that you know, I'm like, oh my God, how do you, you know, how do we not? And then sometimes you have to, just for the space and how everything fits together in the piece. Mm-hmm. And so I want to come back. I want to come back and do more to honor both those people and those relationships, because they put a lot of trust in us.
And that's great. And it serves as motivation, like you said, which is always helpful to artists, you know, and then also honoring people as well is a tough thing to do, like you said. But I feel like, you know, if I could offer some sort of opinion, you know, I always try to welcome that motivation to keep up with who came before me too, because that's sometimes the only thing that keeps me going is trying to build on what was taught to me or what I'm trying to emulate or trying to, you know, keep up with. I always try to like use that as the motivation. Like, man, I gotta do something different. I gotta change my game up. So it sounds like you guys vibrate on such a high level of learning and honoring people who came before you, and then also building up off of that too, which I think is a great approach.
I think this new piece is definitely, you know, one of the most complex pieces in terms of design to execute. So I think that we're also taking on that challenge as part of this process. We're just trying to strive to do, you know, more intricate, more difficult, maybe larger scale, even different mediums, to push ourselves as artists. And, you know, like, I've been fortunate because I've been able to communicate, like, with some of the older muralists. In fact, John Worley donated his scaffolding for this process. Mm-hmm. He said he's retiring from large-scale murals, and he gave me his scaffold.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's a big honor. Yeah. That he thought that I would use it, you know. And, yeah, I probably will, you know. But, like, it's yeah. You know, it's just cool that he considered me worthy of his scaffold to work with that. And, you know, Dan Fonts has consulted and given a lot of beautiful, you know, ideas and just advice around this process. Mm-hmm. And I also talked to Dan Galvez and Keith Sklar. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'm just like, wow, man, like, those are guys that I, like, really, to me, have done so much work on the mural level, you know, and to have them, you know, like, looking at this piece is powerful to me, you know, big honor.
Oh, yeah. And so, like, if we, just to kind of maybe wrap up the 360 mural talk, if we went out there right now, who would we see and what would we possibly see?
Rachel Wolf Goldsmith, mm-hmm. and she is the artistic director of the Bay Area Mural Project. Mm-hmm. And she's another, you know, super talent. And Bay Area Mural Project is, you know, a little bit younger than a lot of the other projects, but they've kind of exploded onto the scene. And they're doing a lot of beautiful community work, but they also have, like, a lot of talent. And they're, you know, primarily POC, and and I just, you know, like, I've been paying attention, you know. I've met, you know, a couple of the other artists, but I'm not, like, you know, like, I haven't engaged them super closely. So this was kind of like, man, I've just been watching you guys do your thing and saying, hey, man, I like it. Let's see if we can bring, like, your artistic director into the fold of this project and connect and make a connection there. So one of the places already, and we're just getting started, where she's really demonstrated her talent is she really knew. I did the design on a tablet on iPad, mm-hmm. In Procreate, and I didn't know. I've used it. I've been drawing with it for, you know, a minute now, but she knew all the techniques and tricks to get it to really look good. You know, and I was like very, very, so I was getting schooled not only in the design, but even before we were putting it on the wall, I was already learning new techniques for how to design this mural. Mm-hmm. So I've been really thankful. And Rachel just had her first day on Friday. So we haven't really worked that tough together yet. But I just know that she's got, you know, incredible talent, and she's putting in a lot of work everywhere. She's getting a lot of jobs, and you know, her career is exploding. So I'm really excited for that. And then last is Dave Kim. And Dave was an early CRP artist when we really started to kind of come out. I really linked up with Dave around 2009, 2010. And Dave was an oil artist, but he had skills. He wanted to learn how to paint. And he could paint with the oil. It just had, he didn't really spray paint that much. And man, over the last, you know, 11 years, Dave's just been, you know, cultivating his skills with everything. And he's just ridiculous. He's just, you know, really, and he does really, really thoughtful, intentional, powerful works. He's really dove deep into his Korean heritage. And the stuff that he's come up with is just amazing. And he's got just realism. He's got it all, vibrant colors, talent, works fast, and just connected to me for a long, long time. And, you know, it's been difficult because Dave kind of moved to L.A., but he's going to come back up for this project. But it's just, we have that history, and he's, you know, he's the type of person that's really, really, you know, humble, but skilled. You know, so like he's gonna get in where he fits in, he's gonna make it work, and he's gonna do just like an incredible job. And so I'm just really excited to work with him. I'm kind of like, because his time is a little more limited with us, I'm kind of theorizing that he's gonna serve as like the closer, like the guy that comes in and tightens up everything just a little bit. But the thing about this team is, like, it's going to be tight already.
Yeah, what's there going to be to tight, you
know,
up, right?
Like, I'm like, Dave, what you going to do here, you know? But, no, he's like, you know, I know he's going to come and just do his thing.
Oh, man, that's got to feel great from your perspective as the lead artist and kind of, like, facilitator for the whole project to have such a nailed-down team just ready to go and your timeline ready to go.
It's great, and it's humbling because they're all better than me. And
well, like you said earlier, you're learning, you know, whatever parts of their process that could possibly work for you, or you know, just knowing sometimes helps.
Hey man, it's all just beautiful, like and then we have like folks coming through. You know, CC Carpio's been showing up and volunteering. From Trust Your Struggle, amazing painter, just so much talent, so much, just so cool, just like just fun to work with and really awesome. And Priya Honda came today and put some work in on that grid, and another amazing talent right now. And then we have like three other younger women volunteers, so it's been an all woman team because Dave's not here,
right?
And I'm, well, besides me. And me, because I'm also like the coordinator.
Yeah.
I'm running around getting everybody paint and brushes and making sure everyone has everything they need.
Yeah.
So it's really just all these incredible, like, powerful women.
Oh, wow.
Doing this work. And I think that like, you know, I think that seeing them, come through and just, wreck shop the way that they wreck shop, it's just, it's really inspiring. And I just, you know, I'm enjoying every minute of that process, you know. It's been going really, really well. So
yeah, and that's going to serve as a great empowerment tool for any Oakland young ladies coming up and seeing that mural up there and know that this is predominantly
people. I'm gonna tell you this right now, like, you know, like, a long time ago, I asked Vulcan about the early women writers, and he was like, man, the early women writers like Charmin and Barbara and Eva, 62, they were not the top women writers. They were the top writers. They were like, they were, as, you know, and this, like, you know, like, these women here, they can keep up with it, you know, like, it's not even about keeping up with it, you know, like, the guys got to keep, like, me got to try to keep up with them.
That's the truth, yeah.
So, you know, it's just, like, I'm hoping to really create a space just to, like, you know, let them, you know, work their magic, and they are, and I'm trying to just get out the way as much as possible, you know, and get in where I fit, and I'll go work in this corner over here because these guys are good, you know. And it's been, you know, just a really beautiful learning experience, you know. And just thankful to be here, you know.
Yeah, and we can't wait to talk with all the rest of the people on the staff too in coming weeks, because of the project. If anybody wants to go see it, they could see the mock-ups on the renderings on crpbayarea.org. And there's actually a picture on the homepage of it, right? And then the and then it has its own page, a description for the 360 mural project. So it has its own section on the website. Yeah. And then, well, and
if you want to get the backstory of how we got here, there's a forthcoming documentary film called Alice Street, directed and produced by Spencer Wilkinson. And so right now we have a trailer online. You can just search YouTube for Alice Street documentary. And we have, of course, our Alice Street film website. And that's, you know, it's going to premiere, or it's going to be shown at the Newport Beach Film Festival, down in Newport Beach, and hopefully in some other places. Right now we're still, you know, kind of in that festival circuit, and it's been a little bit disrupted by this this pandemic. It's a really powerful film about, you know, how this mural helped catalyze, you know, this movement for community benefits. And so I just wanted to mention that, and then also I think that's going to be part of this series that you're doing. Just to talk to Spencer about kind of like how we got here, you know. And I think that story is just as interesting as this current project. And it features, you know, myself and the original artist, one of the other original artists from the Universal Language Mural, Pancho Pescador. And then there's just all of these community members that Spencer filmed. And, you know, it's a powerful, moving story, like, about, you know, resistance, and in a way to get tangible benefits, you know, from, like, I think that, like, you know, the conversation around gentrification is always sort of like, or it's not always, but there's this reminiscing that takes place that, oh, it was cool back then, and then these guys moved in, and now it sucks, and and that's like kind of like the standard dialogue around gentrification versus like, how do we preserve and empower and uplift our cultural institutions in meaningful ways in, you know, in spite or, you know, in resistance to these entities that are trying to move in and take over? How do we like actually hold that ground? And it's difficult, and it's, you know, but we have to, you know, we have to have conversations about what that is about. And so the initial piece was actually about that. The universal language piece was kind of addressing that in certain ways, and now this piece is kind of going beyond that, you know. And we're doing it on the Greenlining Institute. So greenlining, you know, is kind of the antithesis of redlining, which is how you know, communities of color were historically disenfranchised and disinvested in for generations, and how people have been kind of blocked from developing their generational wealth. And greenlining is about like equity and creating that that space for people to be whole. And so that's why I feel so appropriate that this mural is taking place, where it's taking place, how it's taking place, and you know, we're just, you know, really, really fortunate to have a space like this to work with, and to create, you know, something that we hopefully feel like can have a similar impact to what the last piece did, if not more, you know. Right. And I think that the process that we're using of, you know, making a piece that we feel has the capacity to last longer, you know, just physically by the mediums that we're using, in a space that seems more secure, I think that that's a powerful story in and of itself. Right now, you would see, myself, Marina, Elaine, Rachel, probably you might catch Cece and Priya, mm-hmm. a couple other volunteers, and we have already drawn in Terry Bautista, who is a Filipina activist, mm-hmm. And my wife, Jennifer Ana Finifewiaki. Mm-hmm. And you're starting to see Mexica Dansante, Julia Sabori. And that's about the top 30 feet in Kuan Yin, the you know, enlightened Buddhist. Mm-hmm. And you'll see a gigantic hawk at the top of the piece. And you see the legs and stuff and bottoms of a lot of other people because we've also been working on the ground. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there's anybody's actual face is in there on the ground level yet. You're starting to see Jane Kim, and you're starting to see Carlos Acetuno and the founders or like core members of the Greenlining Institute. Mm-hmm. And then eventually they'll all just kind of merge together and come together. So,
well, that's wonderful. And anybody who wants to go and see it, they could go to 360 14th Street, right?
Yeah. There's like a wrought iron fence, very strong wrought iron fence.
Yeah.
And you can just stand on the street and watch us up on the lift. Nice. And you know, it's, honestly, like, I don't know, like, at this moment if it's that exciting because we haven't put any color on the wall yet.
Right.
We're it's still just sketching. We've been working. This is the third week, and we are just drawing in mm-hmm. the images. And hopefully by the end of this week, we will have started coloring or laying base colors because, again, yeah. it's, you know, as part of the process, we're being really, you know, deliberate about how we you know, make the colors pop out.
Yep. Yeah, and basing the colors with different colors that would enhance the finished product is probably one of those ways in which the team that you put together is trying to like streamline the process, right?
Yeah. Or just trying to make it, you know, we're going through all the steps so that it comes out with that gleam, you know. And I think over the next probably 5 to 6 weeks, we're going to color, you know, draw the images in and get it colored.
Yeah.
And I think once that gets going, it's going to kind of move at a different pace. And then, you know, we have a couple extra weeks in there to just put in the final touches and stuff like that. And hopefully done by early to mid-August, all the way. And then we just got to plan our celebration for the dedicated. And then how do we do that? Well, you know, you're social distancing celebration.
Well, out here in Contra Costa County, we're supposed to be getting some good news tomorrow about the rollout of a little bit more activities locally. But, you know, we'll see. I guess the current situation, it's all over the place for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, you know, regardless of what the government says, it's like, you know, keeping our distance is probably a good idea.
It is definitely a good idea, yep.
So I just, you know, it's going to be a minute before, you know, or just in a you know, it's got to be strategic for how we get ourselves together in a safe manner. And we'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, hey, thank you for joining us tonight. And we'll definitely, we'll get together with the rest of the crew through this whole process, and we'll document it as best we can and bring some attention to it. And hopefully we could have a nice party with some social distancing at the end, right?
For sure. For sure. Okay, man.
All right. Hey, cool. Thank you, Desi, for stopping to talk with us.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, and peace.
All right. Peace.
Thanks to Desi Mundo for joining us for the first installment of the 360 Mural series. Next week, we will be joined by Spencer Wilkinson, filmmaker and creator of the Alice Street documentary. And remember, artists out there, let it flow, let it mean something, and goodbye.